Hello everyone, from Glenmont Partners from Nuveen, this is Glenmont Insight. Here, we discuss all things related to energy transition, from policy to technology. With assets in multiple geographies and nearly 4 billion of assets under management, we are one of the largest fund managers focusing exclusively on investments in clean energy infrastructure. To find out more about us, please visit glenmont.com. And don't forget the double N. Welcome to episode 7 of Glenmont Insights. I am your host, Francesc Filiberto, Head of Solar Development at Glenmont Partners from Nuveen. I hope you enjoy the program. The solar energy global capacity has been growing almost exponentially for the last 3 decades. Now this technology is facing an inflection point. According to the International Energy Agency, solar energy can become the main source of power generation, surpassing coal in 2027. Only in the US, during the second quarter of this year, the solar industry installed 6 gigawatts of new capacity, having the best quarter in history, thanks in part to the IRA. But still, Wood Mackenzie expects the US solar market to triple in size over the next 5 years, bringing the total installed solar capacity to 378 gigawatts by 2028. But is this technology mature enough to drive this growth? Can we rely so intensively on solar energy? With me to discuss the future of solar energy in the US is John Burke, CEO of Gringo US, a renewable energy developer. John has more than 20 years' experience in the energy sector, especially solar, and held senior leadership positions at Apex Clean Energy, Shell, and National Renewable Energy Corporation. John, welcome to the podcast.
Good morning. Thank you for having me, Francesc. It's an honor to be here.
John, in the US, the solar industry not only had the best quarter in history, but some experts estimate the market to triple in just 5 years. How do you see this forecast? In your view, what is the potential of the solar energy in the US?
Thanks, Francesc. It's a great question. Ultimately, in the US, we kind of need to take a step back and understand the underground and the cornerstone in which we have as an industry. And in the US, we recently celebrated the 1 year anniversary of the Inflation Reduction Act, the IRA that you mentioned earlier. That concluded some 24 tax provisions, grants, and loan programs that are targeting to accelerate the energy transformation as Wood Mackenzie and others predict. The overall goal is to build an advanced energy economy across all U.S. energy markets. And as the U.S. has multiple energy markets, many are driven by the traditional oil, gas, and coal, which have been the base load and the foundation of certainty of energy supply in our country for decades. Many of the energy tax provisions offer bonus credits that are going to go toward low-income communities and energy communities and have attributes like prevailing wage and registered apprentices, all of which are intended to create an ecosystem of opportunity in the renewable energy sector. So we have legislative direction and policy certainty, which has been missing for most of my career, and two, an executive momentum that is intended to establish stable policy for a decade or more. And so the question is, change never comes without a few bumps in the road. And as this happened last year, we also are dealing with the fact the U.S. trade arm of our federal government identified several global PV module manufacturers for dumping panels made from China and is in the process of assigning new tariffs accordingly, all of which kind of puts together a near-term hiccup on the deployment of solar at scale. We have seen a pause in this application of this through the executive branch for a period of about a year more, but it's still going to have an impact on the overall deployment as we see the supply chain get built out. However, I personally find it impressive how the IRA has shown to be a positive catalyst in onshoring the solar and wind supply chain through the actions that we've mentioned. And this transition period that's going to happen in the next 3 years is going to have opportunities and it's going to have pain points and the like. But it's clear with the announcement of nearly 50 gigawatts of new domestic module manufacturing coming to the United States from the major global players that the IRA is having its positive impact on the overall cornerstone and the framework of which we're going to be building on this energy sector. However, you know, as you can see, the seesaw nature of the module pricing world, which dominates 30% of the CapEx stack kind of going forward, has had impacts globally. You've probably seen it in the EU of pricing of modules kind of going lower and lower because of the oversupply, because they can't land here in the United States. That has caused some near-term issues on the viability of power purchase agreements on the United States, because as the industry resets a new supply-demand balance, we need to kind of look at what that pricing is going to be going forward. And that's a bit of a forecast and a guessing game that we have seen in the past, and it is one in which our industry has been able to meet and to exceed. But, you know, overall, the combination of federal legislative and executive momentum is refreshing. To someone who's been in the industry for almost 20 years, who's seen the fits and starts, it is one in which I kind of finally have the feeling that the solar coaster ride that we are enjoying is having a brief reprieve, at least for a few years. The typical exogenous factors that could impact the overall solar deployment are material, and they're real. Ultimately, access to sufficient tax equity interest at this type of CapEx scale, there's just not enough tax equity liability out there. So we're going to need to find ways in which to monetize tax equity that has not been done in the past. The effects of the higher interest rates on energy pricing and the competitiveness, and that how that drives both the sponsor returns as well as the tax equity returns, is going to have a major kind of impact on how to price point the energy supply, which is ultimately our product. And then the economic interconnection viability and its ability to look at the utility company in which we're interconnecting and rely upon schedules coming out of utilities who are seeing a significant growth on the interconnection queues is going to be an important factor as well. All of this is coupled with the fact that as you see a industry that has been on a growth cycle hit a mature status, we're gonna find some new unique barriers that arise. And as a nascent industry, for as long as I can remember, as we move into maturity, we're going to start to see the face of the full onslaught of entrenched industries like coal, like oil, like natural gas, who will fear the displacement and the threats to their relevancy and overall business models themselves. But ultimately, our industry has shown the grit to adapt to contact, and I truly think the future is bright.
John, what about the energy storage as a complement to solar energy? Here in Europe, we're going to do this comparison a lot today because I am based in Europe. You're based in the U.S. Here in Europe, the use of energy storage system is still relatively low. Ancillary services and capacity markets still need to be developed in many countries. What about the U.S.? What is the potential of energy storage? And how can this technology help solar to become more reliable?
Well, that's a great question. Energy storage and storage alike is the needed component for our industry to hit full maturity. In fact, if you think about what the future of what our product looks like, we're in a period of time where we can just sell the energy curve of a generic solar farm, and overall the grid can adopt and adapt to that energy. But as the saturation levels of intermittent resources climbs, there's going to be a greater focus. And we're seeing it here in the United States, and it'll go in every mature major market, of how to actually shape electrons for demand on the system. And the only way to do that is through storage. Now, the type of storage we're talking about is daily storage. We're not talking about seasonal storage and the like. And so even though our product is on peak daytime hours and in summer hours, that matches up well into markets like Texas and ERCOT, and in some of the Southwest, where you see a significant push for air conditioning and the load that goes onto the grid for that. But you also see a need for storage to displace into other markets, like in North Carolina, where I live, where we're seeing peak periods come at 6 a.m. in wintertime. And so the only way for us to, as an industry, to be relevant in the long run is to be able to shape our power. And the only way to do that is through some form of storage. And battery storage has been at the forefront of its emerging industry status for the last 10, 15 years. We're still seeing it kind of deployed at scale. And our venture with Glenmont in Nuveen, as a matter of fact, is one in which we're starting to see some great progress, where we have nominated several projects, almost, I think, 700 megawatt hours of coupled storage with PV that goes through some of the markets in which we're joining forces. So I think a storage is a near-term need. It's probably not going to be needed until you hit a saturation level that is significant, but it is one in which, as utility planners and those who are looking at providing stable energy for the next 10, 15 years, they're not going to be able to ignore. In fact, you will see a pivot from just bidding solar only to solar storage, and then eventually to kind of what is a virtual power plant world, where the opportunity for the utility to be able to dispatch energy on command within the cycles that they need in order to match the equivalent demand is going to be the future of our industry. And that is exciting, because I think that is actually a differentiated aspect of solar plus battery that coal and or natural gas can't compete with, because effectively they have ramp rates. And whereas we have the ability to have instantaneous contribution to the grid, but it's coming.
John, another hot topic here in Europe is hybridization, especially of solar PV and wind. We start to see a lot of these hybridization developments, even the capacity factor of these technologies that are very complementary, and the saturation of the grid in many European countries. What is your view on this? Is there a potential in the US for hybridization of these two technologies?
I have looked at hybridization for quite some time. In fact, at Apex Clean Energy, we helped one of the U.S. military defense locations in Texas combine off-site wind, and it was ERCOT, Texas-based wind, with local solar. Ultimately, hybridization has a benefit, but in the United States, where land is less scarce, you're seeing less of a desire to co-locate those, because you effectively take some degree of trade-off in siting renewables together if the energy source isn't optimum for both. And let me give you an example. You know, if you look at the state of Texas and you kind of see kind of where the daytime energy production for wind is, it comes from the area close to the Gulf of Mexico, closer to Texas. And so the solar resource for that is 20% less than actually a West Texas-based solar. So in the United States, where we have less of a scarcity of land, we're seeing less deployment of hybridization, but there does appear to be a movement in Europe to do just this. We're seeing this in our own portfolios that we're developing, and we're staying on top of it, because you're absolutely right. Typically, the wind profile peaks at night and solar peaks during the day, and it has the ability to kind of be blended well together. We did some analysis in the past at Apex, and I'm sure it's data at this point. But when you're combining roughly three megawatts of wind for 1 megawatt of solar, you can kind of end up with a very stable platform, and you can bid that into a grid without having significant amount of shaping of the off hours. But that said, you know, when scarcity of land becomes more of a problem, that is the natural response, is how to do more in the same footprint. I think also in the United States, we have slightly different geographies where our wind is in the mid-continent. And so if you drew a line from basically the western side of Texas to the eastern side of Texas and drew it straight up to Canada, most of the wind profile that matches commercial kind of needs will fit into that category. Now, we still have some in further west in California and others, but if you would look at the endowment of what the U.S. has, that is where it is. But that's not where most people live. And so I think what we end up having is we end up having to transport that renewable endowment to markets that go through that. And the question is hybridization of wind and solar and transporting both, does it still make sense when you could actually get the same resource co-located with load? And as you know, there are certain benefits to locating generation near load. And until that phenomenon kind of shakes out in the United States, we'll probably see it more ad hoc than you'll see it as a standard product.
John, I'd like to bring your attention now to utilities and oil companies and their relationship with the solar industry. In Europe, we have seen these companies ignoring the solar industry for years. However, very recently, they have started focusing their investment on renewables. So companies like Repsol, Iberdrola, Enel, Galp, Total. Which is the role of utilities and oil companies in the U.S. solar landscape? And are they willing to become a major player in the solar industry?
Well, since I work for Shell, I kind of have a unique perspective on this. We formed Shell Wind Energy sometime in 2004, 2005, and I joined in 2006 to grow a energy business that was alternative fuels. As we built that business for 5-6 years, effectively the strategy engine of Shell shifted gears. And it commonly happens in oil and gas company where there will be a great idea and then there'll be the shift and then there'll be the return to the status quo. And that's exactly what we faced. In 2010, they effectively said, great, good job building a brand, good job building the megawatts that we have installed. But quite frankly, we're going to deploy our CapEx toward industries that are more aligned with our value chain and our distribution channels. And so they weren't quite ready to let go of the status quo. Now, the question is, 15 years later, will that be the same answer? And as I mentioned before, the entrenched nature of which these companies have in their endowment, which is all of the infrastructure that they need in order to compete, will likely shift more toward hydrogen than it will be shifting toward renewable energy. I think in the United States, I would see more of a fit for an ExxonMobil to kind of deploy at large capital the need to kind of build together P2X or P to hydrogen. And that's kind of where I see the U.S. differing slightly than the European market, because there are a significant amount of utility players. And if you look at oil and gas, until there's a significant shift in our transportation industry, they are sitting on a cash cow. And the question is at what point do you monetize a portion of your cash cow and realize change? And I don't think we're there yet. In particular, I think ExxonMobil is going to be the laggard, but they also have the greatest balance sheet. And so when they decide to jump into this industry, it will be a large splash. And it'll be one in which they will seek to dominate and take the first position. But I will tell you, the groups like Enel and Iberdrola and others, they could have a fit out here, but quite frankly, it's still roughly and very fragmented as to the ownership of overall renewables across the country.
John, we start to see the first regulation in Europe for solar communities. But the first time that I heard this concept was actually from a US-based solar developer. So how well established are solar communities in the US and what are the key drivers of their growth?
Well, that's a great question. So solar communities have been developed because of a lack of ability for people to control and to have sufficient supply of generation to match their load. And so a lot of times when you're thinking about solar communities, it has to do with the density of the regions in which there have certain population centers and the ability for those people to want to participate and to see an offset of their own personal uses. I'll be honest, it's a boutique industry here in the United States, and it's one in which many different policies, and typically they're state-driven policies, have attempted to see that get pushed forward. But quite frankly, when you're looking at the overall cost and the scale approach, it has been difficult to finance, especially in the world of the United States, where X equity has to participate in a large chunk of the CapEx stack, and understanding where the other sources of revenue are going to be coming from to fill out the balance is going to be difficult to do. There have been some banks that have gotten involved and gotten more comfortable with financing community solar, But as it is in the United States, I don't think that will be that which prompts a significant change. I think it'll be an industry that will continue to grow, but it won't be that which is the pace of energy transformation in the United States.
Okay. John, what about the local manufacturing industry? So, of course, the IRA has an impact, but very interesting for me was the case of First Solar. 2 years ago, we read that they sold their entire development pipeline to concentrate on manufacturing. Is the local manufacturing industry in the U.S. going to take off? Just remembering now that in Europe, this modern manufacturing industry just collapsed some years ago.
As I think I mentioned it briefly in the first question, the domestic solar growth in the United States is truly amazing to see. If that which is announced actually comes to fruition, we're going to see 50 gigawatt peak plus of new solar manufacturing here onshored, away from players like in Southeast Asia, China, and others. And so that is probably one of the most important earmarks of the IRA benefits for that, which is what we've been lacking in our industry for so long, which is certainty. With a U.S.-based module supply chain, we are going to have much less concerns about a wake effect of the overall pricing. And I think the announcements of First Solar, Jinko, Trina, JA, Maxeon, and others, the list is probably over 25 now long. It's really impressive to see how the IRA has spurned this. Now, it's not without its complication, because the U.S. IRS has come together with some very convoluted and somewhat perplexing guidance on how to take advantage of the domestic content benefit associated with the IRA. And just to give you an example, if you are able to demonstrate a domestic supply for a project, you could get an additional 10% tax credits associated with the value of that. Now, that 10% tax credit benefit is a large mover in any sort of pro forma. And I think as the financial modeling gets done, most of us are looking at that domestic benefit in a way that can kind of really help shape the type of returns that we expect for years to come. But as we've seen in the short run, that 10% benefit has gone to others other than the sponsor and the tax equity sponsor. And I think that's the interesting aspect of kind of where domestic content will go, is who will get the source of that value. Will it be the primary sponsor that will get it, or will it be the overall energy buyer for a lower levelized cost of energy? It's probably going to be obviously a mix, but eventually it will be driven down to a level where the cost of energy will get reduced over time. Now, that isn't a bright spot for those of us who would like to see slightly a little more comfortable margins in our industry, because when you're bidding into PPAs and the like, they are clearing based on cost primarily. And I think one of the challenges that we face is how to ensure that there is room in these benefits for the entire industry and the sector to benefit. And when it comes down to it, tax equity has been a big mover in the past, and they have been able to flex their muscles. When it comes down to monetization of the tax credit benefit. So, the question is overall, as these projects get built, how will we see the monetization of the benefits of these type of incentives, and who will gain from those benefits? And as much as I would like to see the sponsors take the majority share, I have a feeling it's going to be translated into other forms of benefits associated with either higher priced modules, where alternatively, if we sourced from an international supply, we would have paid slightly less. It's probably going to end up with slightly higher rent fees for landowners, and its tax equity is going to take their slice of the pie, and others. But ultimately, U.S. module manufacturing is a cornerstone, and it is a pivot point for us as an industry that we've never had before. And it's kind of nice to see that, because quite frankly, that once industry is established, the debates between Democrats and Republicans kind of come to a head, right? Because in the past, Democrats and Republicans could basically kind of fight one another without any sort of local kind of interface as trade-offs. And as we grow as an industry, and especially as we want to grow at the scale of an energy transformation industry, looking at the trade-offs of how policy will impact U.S. Supply chain will have to be addressed by both parties. And I think that's going to offer greater policy stability, and it'll also kind of take away a little bit of the nexus of us and them. Because quite frankly, when you combine red and blue, you get purple. And I've always seen the renewable energy sector and solar in particular as a very purple industry. There should be no reason why we shouldn't be seen as a value add across all boards. Because if you think about where the next dollar of capital is coming to rural America, it's not coming from oil and gas manufacturers. It's not coming from the data centers. At the scale we're talking about here, it's the renewable energy industry. And I'm proud to be a part of that, because as we stabilize the fabric of rural America, we stabilize America. And that's an important benefit that gets translated over time. But nonetheless, I think I probably went too far on various tracks, but if you have any further questions, I'd love to explore those with you.
Okay, that's it for this episode of Glenmont Insights. I hope you enjoyed it. Be sure to follow us and subscribe so you don't miss a single episode. A big thank you to our guest, John Burr, for joining us today. Thank you for listening. Until next time.